First, I'd like to recognize my co-author Sabina and Nick Comerford and Willie Harris, and I also put a really important person here on the author list that's not here, Aegis Stop, who was instrumental for a lot of the field work that happened for this project. This is a core project of the North American Carbon Program and was funded by a formerly AFRI grant that's NEPA. Now we hear, and I'm sure in this meetings you've heard a lot of, and probably at the point like this in a slideshow where someone says, well, carbon is really important because of these global pools and of these soil pools. And we hear a lot of these large numbers, but we have to, especially as soil scientists who understand the spatial relationships in the landscape, we have to really step back and think about whether these estimates really represent the scale of where things are happening, and if when we aggregate things from that scale, if they really match. So this research was designed to address that project, and there are a number of parts of this research project, but the number one goal is to assess carbon fraction stocks in the state of Florida, and I'll talk about what fractions we measure here in a minute. We have an opportunity to detect change, and so there's a little aspect of that. We'll be developing some models, and I'll talk about some geospatial models today. And hopefully we can infer something about the processes that are controlling soil organic carbon distribution in this southeastern Florida landscape. A little bit about the design and field work and some of the lab methods. We use a random stratified design. So we stratify the state of Florida by soil suborder and by land use and land cover. And this led to 89 strata that cover over 70% of the land area of Florida. Really represents the range of soil carbon landscapes, or the range of landscapes and ecosystems we expect to see. This is a little bit about this is what it looks like. Won't go into too much about the historic and reconnaissance, but we have an opportunity to revisit and look at change in this data set. So we went to these locations, we measured their location with DGPS, we took four samples, and I'll be reporting on 20 centimeter data here. It's 1,014 sites and took over a year to get. It was a very, very large project to manage in the field. We've measured total carbon and organic carbon, the soil organic carbon by subtraction between those two. We have a hot water extractable carbon and a non-hydrolyzable carbon. So the SOC represents, again, that organic carbon. The hot water is more of a labile fraction. That's labeled HC throughout this talk. And then the non-hydrolyzable is what's not dissolved by acid. So it's a recalcitrant, and then that's the RC. So our main goal is to assess carbon stocks. And this is just a little bit of just an overview of what numbers we got from those 1,014 samples. The ranges, the means, and what's, I think, critical to look at here is the skewed nature of this data set and how difficult it is to model these kind of data because of their distributional forms. And so we might rather use some kind of a non-parametric technique to handle this kind of data. And in particular, in this talk, I'll be talking a little bit about some data mining techniques that really don't care about the distributional form of this data. Now, once we have a map, once we have our data, we can post it as a map. And you look at this and you can maybe squint back and see a few areas that have some structure that you might say there's some carbon concentrated. But when you look at this, it's pretty difficult. This is the Everglades agricultural area, histosols. But it is a little bit difficult to look at this map and see that we're really capturing the scale, even with the variation at the scale, even with 1,014 samples. And we can interpolate this. Looking at this semivariogram, we take a look here at the lag distance, and it pretty much the upper limit of the spatial variability that we're able to relate with this is about 90 kilometers. But then it only goes down to about 10 kilometers. We really can't get much better than that with just a straight up kind of Cregan approach to this. What that says is that there's a lot of spatial structure out there, and we're not, even with 1,014 samples, it's very difficult to capture what's happening in this landscape. And we can make that map and make an interpolation, but hopefully from that semivariogram you see that we can see some broad trends out here, but we're not capturing the landscape in detail. We need another way to do that. This is what Florida really looks like. The areas that are in green are histosols. They have a very high organic carbon and organic matter content. And then maybe perhaps immediately adjacent there, you can see this clear cut right next to there. That's a very, very sandy surface soil. So our models have to be able to capture the scale that carbon is changing the landscape. And that's a challenge. So similar to a lot of other people, our technique is to use some other kind of data, some continuous data that's available from across the region, to provide some underlying trend model that helps explain the carbon variation. And we follow the factorial model approach. This model is a model that a lot of you will be familiar with, the Scorpion model, very similar to the Clorps model, except that we would use soil variables also in our predictive models. So we'll be focusing on the development of this function right here and this Q matrix. I'll talk a little bit more about this Q matrix. And this is the matrix of our environmental correlates. And the function in our case is just going to be a data mining model. And it provides the underlying model. And this is the, kind of the place where we're at in our research. We're developing these models right now. And so we'll be using a lot of the same kind of data that many of you have seen before. This is an available water capacity map to 1 meter from Sirgo. The Sirgo data is really important for these models. Here's an example of some climate data. This is some remote sensing data that's available. I think this is 250 meter resolution. I believe that's right, MODIS data. And elevation data, we have three different DEMs that we're including, and some geologic information. So our matrix is pretty large. We spent a lot of time putting together these environmental correlates, and if you see them grouped by Scorpion factors, we had 29, and I think a little bit more than this now, actually, in this latest set of data. And these are mainly Sirgo attributes that we've converted into raster for our models. We have 39 climate variables and almost 90 organism variables, and these are mostly remote sensing. And now, with the climate and the organism variables, these aren't just one layer, they're multi-temporal information. For instance, we might have MODIS NDVI for 12 days of the year, so quite a large set of information. Some, as I said, three different topographic DEM models. So we have 185 layers that are going into our prediction model. It's a pretty big data set to deal with, and keep in mind that we also have to deal with the square extent in these raster models, so there's a lot of extra storage space that we have to deal with, and we're up to about a half a terabyte of information in producing these. It's pretty time-consuming and computationally intensive. I'm sure some of you recognize that. So we tried several modeling techniques, and I'm just going to show you results from one because it's often the best, and I'm enjoying using it right now because it's very flexible to use. And that's just random forest techniques. These are all tree-based techniques, but random forest is often the best one, and it's fairly easy to use. So I'll just be showing results from random forest from here out. And this is, visually, this is what our model looks like. And if I didn't mention it, but the R-square for this one was 0.67. It's a little bit less than that for this. These are predicted versus observed, so this is soil organic carbon, and this is recalcitrant carbon, and this is the hot water extractable or labile kind of carbon. And you see, as we go to these other carbon fractions, that the predictions are not as good. They're sort of secondary things, and so we're working on improving that. Now, so one of the things that you get from these random forest models are variable rankings. And you can't see the names of these variables, but what these graphs show are the increase in mean squared error by randomly permuting this one of these variables. So the variables that rank high provide the most information to the model. And by looking at these rankings, we can infer some things about the processes that are causing variation up here. And so this is the top six or so or eight maybe of the soil organic carbon random forest very important variables. And Sirgo Great Group is really important. So the soils data is providing a lot of information to us. This is the land cover land use. This is 30 meter Landsat-derived land cover data. So we get this polygon data, but we also get this raster information that's providing some additional structure to our model. And these available water is really important. A couple of these pop up, 20, 50, and 100. And Sirgo organic matter. I mean, there's organic matter information in the soil map already, and we can use it. It's just an example of what's important out there. Well, so as you saw, and I've explained, we have a lot of these data layers. And it's very challenging to take a random forest model and 180 data layers and apply that model at every single pixel location, 24,000 by 24,000 for the whole state of Florida. It's really, I'm not sure how to do that. And I've tried. In fact, I've been having a lot of trouble even to get smaller models to work, and hoping to advance some of the computational techniques we might use to get that done. So what I'm showing here are three variables, the soil organic carbon, recalcitrant carbon, and the hot water extractable, with different numbers of predictors to see just how low down we can go in the important variables. So what I'm going to highlight here is that with soil organic carbon, with about 25 variables, and that's the top 25 from the full model, we can do a really good job. We can capture almost 100% of our explained root mean squared error. So it reduces the computation that we have to do to project our model across the landscape. Now the other variables, probably because they don't fit so well, take more variables to predict them. And so this is where we're at. I got this map on Monday. This has been a real challenge to apply these models spatially. And this map took about 16 hours to calculate. And it is the map of soil organic carbon based on our best model. So we have more work to do to develop these maps and error surfaces from them. So in conclusion, I have a couple of slides to talk about why these things happen and why these variables are important. We have a gradient of moisture and vegetation in Florida. And for example, we see a really sandy site here on the left that's very dry soil, a more moist location in the center, and then a lot of Florida is swamp. And so the gradient of moisture is one of the driving variables that is obvious from our models and is giving us some predictive power. And that interacts with vegetation gradients. We go everywhere from these really thick forests to open canopy forests to open prairies. And so these are the things that our NDVI maps and our land surface classification maps are predicting. This is how those are helping our predictions. I think in the interest of time, I'll just skip over this. But the wet classes are on top there, and they have higher organic carbon than the drier classes. So in the end, the results are that data mining is useful. It helps when you have these really large data sets that are not normal and difficult to handle. We found that the controlling factors in our landscape were soil moisture variables and vegetation variables. But now we're able to quantify these gradients and make some maps. I'll conclude.
Thank you.
It's time for one question.
R, yeah, there's a random forest routine in R.
Okay.
Yeah, and actually specifically, R, yeah.
It sounds like in your model you had a lot of different layers and variables that you were using. Did you check any for, correlations? And I think the principles like collinearity, when you have too many variables.
Yeah. Yeah, we expect them. In fact, it's obvious that many of them are correlated. One of the values of the random forest modeling technique is that it doesn't matter as much. It's much less sensitive to that problem than a linear modeling technique where the variables are linearly combined with coefficients. Instead, with regression trees, it's just really just this recursive binning of the data. And whether or not they're correlated, they in one tree they might be there, in one tree they might not. They might not be together. So it actually helps to have more variables in there, even if they're correlated. It's something you worry about, but with random forests, it's not as much of an issue.